I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Some residents of central Tennessee have been coping with what some are calling an environmental catastrophe. An earthen dam holding tons of ash broke at a coal plant in Harriman, Tennessee, which is about 40 miles west of Knoxville. The break sent more than 5 million cubic yards of ash sludge into the surrounding area, covering hundreds of acres. In some cases, it's several feet deep. This potentially toxic sludge is stored at hundreds of coal plants around the nation. In fact, the byproducts of coal burning are the second largest waste stream in the country. For the latest on this spill, we're joined by Ann Payne. She's environmental reporter for the newspaper The Tennessean. And Ann, this coal ash is called a post-combustion byproduct from the coal power plant. Can you tell us what it is exactly?
Well, when the coal is burned, it turns into ash, and there are different kinds of ash. There's the bottom ash, which is the clunkier, bigger component of the ash, and then there's the fly ash, which goes up the stacks. It's fine, like a face powder. It's where chemicals can be concentrated, and heavy metals. You'll have mercury and arsenic, lead, other potential toxic materials.
In the ash, which is why environmentalists are so concerned.
That's right. Mm.
So this basically, you called it an ash pond. This is sort of a huge landfill, if you will, that stores all of this fly ash in it.
It's sort of a quasi-landfill. It's what they do with the fly ash, which is this light, powdery substance. They mix it with water and sluice it over to this pond. This is a 40-acre pond, the one that broke. There's some other ponds on site there. And the ash settles out of the water. The water is allowed to run off, and then they dredge the ash out and put it in another, even drier pond. The plant opened in the 1950s. They've been using the pond for decades. And with this particular ash pond, the site was limited around the Kingston steam plant, the coal-burning plant. So instead of being able to spread out these ponds in a wider area, they started building it up. So it was built high into the air, and that's why there was so much force behind it. Now, whether it had anything to do with having more than it was supposed to, or what the reason for the collapse was, we're still waiting to see. They say they walk it almost every day. They have a formal report on it every year. They have had some leaks. Their residents are the first ones that told us there'd been leaks there in years past. And when pressed on that, TVA finally provided their records that we hadn't seen before and said, well, there'd been a mini blowout, a little blowout in 2003 and another in 2006. How far out it got, I don't know. The residents described it as looking very much like what is now all over the ground.
Can you describe what folks are telling you about the scene right there in Harriman right now?
Well, it's pretty bad. There's this slush that is run across, they're not even sure how many acres, somewhere between 250 and 400 acres. A lot of it was wildlife habitat. Some of it was a neighborhood where the dozen houses were damaged. And you see this muck halfway up the first floor of a house. One house was knocked off its foundation by the sheer force of this ash slide. They're calling it a slide, as it knocked down power poles and trees and left this muck many feet deep in many places. There was a bay of the Emory River, which is beside the plant, and it completely filled in with this muck, and it was at least 20 feet and probably much deeper in some places. Mm. And that's when the ash slide came rumbling down, it hit that bay, and it tossed the water and the fish in it out, and a lot of the fish ended up on land.
And so, in terms of major water supplies nearby, are those affected as well?
This is part of the Tennessee River system. The Emory runs into the Clinch, which runs into the Tennessee River. And there are water intakes up and down these waterways. The closest one downriver is about 6 miles downriver from where the ash slide took place. And officials have been checking that. And they say that as long as it goes through normal treatment, there's no problem.
They say the water is safe, basically.
That's right. Hmm.
It's my understanding that the Tennessee Valley Authority is now saying it will find an alternative place to dispose of this ash.
That's right. Right now they're talking about they have other ponds on site, and they haven't, they say they are working on something, and they haven't come up with anything yet. Environmentalists for years tried to get the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to declare this as a hazardous waste. This is something the coal industry has argued against, and it has never happened. And this is providing a chance for environmentalists to speak up and go, this is why it needs to be more closely regulated. And also they're saying people should be testing the sludge that's actually on the ground. TVA is doing a lot of water testing, but they've never talked about testing the sludge. The EPA is talking about testing the sludge, but the results aren't back from that yet.
Do you know where cleanup stands right now and how long it might take?
They say it's going to take several weeks. The neighbors are finding that pretty hard to believe because of the extent of it. And if it's determined that this material is highly toxic, then it could end up as a Superfund site that requires a massive cleanup.
Ann Payne is environmental reporter for the newspaper The Tennessean. Next week is the start of the new year, the time when many of us promise to do all sorts of good things. Eat healthier, exercise more, lose weight, save money. Turns out that all of those things could also mean there will be more New Year's to celebrate. But what about living to that golden of golden ages, 100? Is it about moderation, diet, and exercise? But then why is it that some people eat junk food and smoke cigarettes and still live longer than vegetarians who run marathons? For more on that, we turn to someone who spent a lot of time with the Over 100 set. Dr. Thomas Pearls is director of the New England Centenarian Study. He's looked at 1,500 centenarians, and he's also devised an online calculator to determine a person's life expectancy. And Dr. Pearls, is your research focused on people who live longer or those who live longer and have a better quality of life?
We're actually trying to do both, where by discovering the secrets, both genetic, environmental, behavioral, as well as luck, we hope not to get everyone to be 100, but rather to get everyone to live as long as possible, compressing the time that they experience disability towards the very end of their lives. And it's my belief that most of us should be able to live well into our late 80s with good health behaviors. And then the extra years beyond that may rely upon some discoveries with the centenarians.
So most of us can live into our 80s, provided that we don't push it too much, if you will. Would that be sort of a general rule of thumb?
Well, we learned this from the Seventh-day Adventists, which is this religion that dictates certain health behaviors. As a group, they are vegetarian, they regularly exercise, they don't really overdo anything, including eating, so that they tend to be lean. They don't smoke, and they spend a lot of time with family and religion, which translates probably into managing their stress very well. And lo and behold, they have the highest life expectancy in the country of 88 years. What the Seventh-day Adventists and the centenarians show us, it's much more a matter of the older you get, the healthier you've been. And for people who are living to the average life expectancy, which is around 78 years, they're experiencing a lot of disability prior to their death. You have to be pretty darn sick to die at 78, actually, in my opinion. And the difference is, are these good health behaviors? Now, granted, maybe you don't have to be vegetarian, but I do think walking every day for 30 minutes a day, eating in moderation, certainly not smoking, are really key factors. And the centenarians are uncanny in their ability to manage stress well. And all these things come out in this life expectancy calculator that I have at livingto100.com. And people can go on there and answer about 40 questions, and out will spit their life expectancy with, of course, a money-back guarantee.
You know, I noticed some interesting things on there that I'd like to ask you about. For example, you ask whether people floss their teeth, whether they take supplements with iron. Why are those important things?
Gum disease, which is inflammation of the gums, harbors bacteria and inflammatory substances that get spewed out into the bloodstream. And those very same bacteria in your gums are actually found in the plaque of the blood vessels that feed your heart, which leads to what's called coronary artery disease and ultimately heart attack. With regard to the iron that you asked about, 85% of centenarians are actually women, and only 15% are men. And there's this long-held question about why women win the longevity marathon. And there had been thoughts about estrogen. But another really interesting idea is that women menstruate for about 45 years or so. And as a result, they're relatively iron deficient compared to men. And it may be that iron deficiency that's a real advantage, in that iron plays a really important role in our cells' ability to produce these free radicals, which are these very damaging molecules and atoms that glom onto our cell membranes and our DNA that probably play a really important role in aging.
So women would have a diminished capability to produce the free radicals.
That it may be as simple, though I doubt it, as less iron means less free radical production.
But you put some stock in it, obviously. It's in your calculator.
It is, and I've actually been quoted in some very strange places where I say that I purposely try to menstruate every 8 weeks. And the way I do that is I go to the Boston Medical Center blood donor room and donate a unit of blood every 8 weeks. Now, I do that in part because I have a pretty rare blood type. But I don't think I'm being entirely altruistic by trying to become a little iron deficient.
You also, in your calculator, give folks recommendations about how they can increase their life expectancy. And so they typically are some of the big ones. If folks smoke, they should stop right away. What are some of the others?
One has to do with what I call bodybuilding for the brain. These would be things like doing Sudoku and Scrabble and Bridge and other games. The key is that once you get good at them, you either go up a level or you do something entirely different. The biggest heavyweights would be learning a new language or a musical instrument. And this builds what we call cognitive reserve. Hopefully what one does is, if there is any kind of problem down the road, like memory loss or even something like Alzheimer's disease, it's going to take longer for that problem to show a clinical effect, to be clinically evident.
Let's go back to your centenarians for a moment. Only one in 6,000 Americans is a centenarian. I read that statistic. What do they have? Is it luck? Is it genes? What is it?
The most dramatic finding is that this runs very strongly in families. So, for example, if you look at the brothers of centenarians, the brothers themselves have about an 18 times greater chance of living to 100, and the sisters of centenarians have about eight times greater chance. And when you look at the kids, it may sound funny, are actually in their 70s and early 80s, they are very much following in the footsteps of their parents, with up to 80% reduced rates of heart disease, stroke, diabetes, cancer, and already in their 70s, a 20% reduced mortality rate compared to other people born around the same time who don't have centenarians in their families. So we want to find out what secrets these family members have in common that would allow them to get to such old age. These would be things like genetic variations and various habits, even things like education and socioeconomic status that clearly do run in families.
Dr. Thomas Pearls of the New England Centenarian Study. We'll be back with him after a quick break, and we'll ask, is there or could there be a pill to help you live longer? Later in the show, programming your home to use less electricity. We'll be back in a minute. Here and Now. We're talking about living to the ripe old age of 100. Why do some people live a long time, even if they don't have very healthy habits? And what about all those anti-aging products and longevity supplements? Do they help? Dr. Thomas Pearls is director of the New England Centenarian Study. He looked at 1,500 centenarians to try to figure out why they live longer. And he says we could learn something from Seventh-day Adventists, who tend to eat moderately, don't smoke, and spend time with their families and their religion. And while his research has confirmed that healthy habits are key, Dr. Pearls also uncovered some surprises. And, Doctor, tell me about the man who lived to be 103, even though he was a heavy smoker, into his 90s, and drank 3 martinis a day. What's going on in this case?
People like this are very rare. I can probably count on just the fingers of one hand how rare we find individuals who've basically thrown everything equivalent to an atomic bomb at themselves, and they're still doing very well. And this man not only had those horrible habits, he was completely cognitively intact. When I went to see him, he was repairing his roof. It was phenomenal. And he had said that he had stopped smoking in his early 90s because he started thinking living to 100 would be cool. But he continued the 3 martinis a day. This is where we start looking into the discovery of what we call longevity-enabling genes that would help slow down the rate of aging and decrease your risk for age-related diseases. For the most part, our discoveries have been so far around looking at disease-related genes and the fact that the centenarians lack a lot of the variations associated with premature heart disease, stroke, and so on. But men like that man and also our super centenarians, people who live to 110 and older, I think are the ones that really hold the secrets to what's really our holy grail, which is the longevity-enabling genes.
You know, some of the research that's being done to try to see what other things might enable longevity included something that was very interesting. Where calorie intake was reduced.
A relatively few number of people can really stick to these very low kind of calorie diets. You almost have to be obsessed with it minute by minute throughout your day. And a lot of people would say that it diminishes quality of life so much that it's just not worth it to extend that life. But certainly studies in mice show that calorically restricting a mouse to the level of, say, 800 calories a day in a human increases their lifespan by about 30%, and they also have markedly reduced rates of cancer. So there is something to that.
There was also a study done by Cynthia Kenyon, I think, at the University of California at San Francisco, about genes in roundworms and what that suggests. Can you briefly summarize that for folks and tell us what we can take from that?
Well, the genes that Cynthia has been looking at also play a role of why caloric restriction might be healthy for you. Cynthia and actually David Sinclair at Harvard Medical School and a company called Sertris are looking at these underlying mechanisms with the hope that maybe they could make a pill, for example, that would mimic the beneficial effects of caloric restriction. So you take the pill instead of having to go through all of that caloric restriction to get the same benefit.
So if, in fact, researchers are looking at some of these studies and saying maybe there is a pill, what about the pills that are now on the market that claim to help with longevity, like a human growth hormone pill that we hear about, or different supplements?
So that's all pure quackery. There is no substance out there that anyone can sell where they can claim that it stops or reverses aging. And growth hormone, if they are trying to sell it as a pill or as a spray, it might as well be eating sand or drinking water, only because if that was growth hormone, it could never get into your system by those routes. The only way growth hormone works is if it's injected. And for those who fall for the claim that injectable growth hormone stops or reverses aging are completely being taken for a ride. It costs about $1,000
a month. It's expensive, right.
It's $1,000 a month. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence showing that actually growth hormone has the absolute opposite effect. It would shorten lifespan, and it probably increases the risk for cancer. It's been shown to have an increased risk for diabetes and high blood pressure and a few other medical problems. But this is the anti-aging industry at its best in terms of marketing. And growth hormone is a great name to market, but it is pure quackery at best and downright dangerous and unethical at worst.
So then, I hate to even ask you, might we be able to one day take a pill that would help, increase longevity?
Scientists and the pharmaceutical industry are working on drugs that are more related to age-related diseases. If there's something they might do to the baseline rate of aging, the likely impact of that is not so much getting people to much older age, but to try and decrease their risk for age-related diseases, primarily heart disease, stroke, and diabetes, maybe cancer. That I foresee happening over the next 10 years.
So folks who say this is just a bunch of baby boomers not wanting to die and the world can't handle all of these people, you would say what we're talking about here is really quality of life, and it would actually be less expensive in the long run because we're talking about reducing disease.
That's absolutely right. Centenarians are a group that, again, they markedly delay disability towards the end of their lives. They're among our least expensive in terms of age group when it comes to healthcare. I am a very strong optimist when it comes to aging, and I believe in this notion of not anti-aging, but aging well. And the vast majority of people like Seventh-day Adventists should be able to live almost 30 years beyond the age of 60 with very good quality of life. They just need to take the effort to take good care of themselves. Again, get into these self-reinforcing habits. I'm not saying for you to be vegetarian, but maybe you do need to reduce red meat in your diet, which, by the way, is our primary source of iron in our diet, and maybe why red meat is not so good for you. Do the 30 minutes of walking, not smoking, and figuring out ways to manage your stress well.
Those are the biggies.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Dr. Thomas Pearls is director of the New England Centenarian Study. He's been talking with us about living longer. And next week on Here and Now, with the Madoff scandal and the bad economy, we'll look at charitable giving in 2008. That's next week. Still ahead today, a study suggests that more men than women get ahead at work because they ask for what they want twice as often as women do. So a woman blogger decided to see what happened when she started asking for things. Her story coming up Here and Now. If you knew how much electricity you use every day, every hour, even every minute, do you think you would remember to turn off the lights when you left a room? Well, utility companies, mainly in California, Texas, and the Northeast, are investing $18 billion to put that information at your fingertips in an effort to get people to conserve. Consumers will even be able to compare their energy use to their neighbors and set up an automatic schedule to turn off lights and appliances to lower their bills. For more on all this, we're joined by Adrian Tuck. He's CEO of Tendril, a company that makes products which allow homeowners to keep track of their power use. Adrian, welcome.
Hello.
We have one of your products here in the studio with us called the Tendril Insight, and that tracks kilowatts and costs of energy per hour. And we will sort of experiment with that with you on the line with us in just a minute. But before we do, let's talk about first why utilities are trying to go toward these smart meters and an interactive smart grid.
If you think about the history of the utility industry, every time demand has gone up, they've increased supply, so more and more power stations. That's becoming both financially and politically difficult to sustain. The cost of power stations, of building new power stations, have doubled in the last 4 years. So utilities are looking for new ways to manage demand in order to make sure that they're able to meet the requirements of consumers.
So what do we know about monitoring the way we consume now? How do most places do it right now in terms of monitoring energy consumption?
Well, I think we're famously in the dark. We have no information at all about what we consume. Our utility typically gives us a bill 45 days after we finish a billing period, and it has one number on it, which is the total summary of consumption. So what the smart grid's about is trying to give consumers real-time information about their consumption. And what we see is consumers reacting to three drivers: the desire to save money, the desire to save the planet, and perhaps most interestingly, the desire to do better than the neighbors.
And the way you do that, essentially, is you can watch exactly online what your consumption is through some of these products.
That's correct. So typically we touch consumers in three ways: online, with devices such as the Insight display you have there in the studio, and coming soon through the cell phone.
So I'm looking at your device right now in the studio. It's a small box about the size of a GPS, and it's not hooked into an electric meter. So what you've done is set us up with a computer program that simulates what my energy costs would be based on the size of my house and where I live. So here we go. We just click with the bare basics running. My electricity costs 36 cents per hour. But let's try this. Let's tell the computer that I'm turning on more appliances. My clothes dryer, water heater, air conditioner, and let's say I'm using 100-watt light bulbs instead of 60 watts. So if we click and see what happens there, okay, now the cost shoots up to $1.97. That's a considerable difference.
That's right. So you've sort of increased your cost per hour by about sixfold. And so it's relatively easy to sort of see how this works in a world where electricity stays the same price all of the time. But what's coming over the next couple of years is a rollout of variable price electricity. So more and more the utility will be offering you programs where there's cheaper electricity to be had in the evenings than there is during the day. And so you'll be able to see the financial benefit of running your dishwasher at 9 at night as opposed to 9 in the morning.
Why would the utility want me to use more energy at night as opposed to during the day?
The utility industry is staffed, if you like, to meet the peak requirements that typically happen during the day when air conditioning is running and so on. So they have a whole series of power stations that are running at full power during the day that are sitting largely idle at night. And so to the extent that you can shift load, move your consumption into times when the utility industry is not busy, that's cheaper for them to supply you electricity. It's often more environmentally beneficial as well, as they have to run less generation during the day.
And so how do you think you might get consumers to respond to these types of programs and to do something like this, to try to type in and see what they're using and maybe take steps then to conserve?
I think it starts with education. So users need to understand the impact of the devices they're using in the home on their bill. So to start with, I think what you'll see is just information. So the in-home display that you see, the little device that would sit in the kitchen, would just show you in real time what you're consuming. And as you go about your day, you'll start to understand the impact of turning the dishwasher on and off and so on. And that then quickly gets followed with some level of user control. So the idea that you, the consumer, can then start to set budgets or thresholds for your devices. So you may say, I only want to set a $150 budget for my air conditioning. And you'd put that into the web portal, and then our system would populate the rules in your thermostat to manage it to that sort of budget.
Are people using these right now?
There are a few hundred homes around the U.S. that have been outfitted with systems like ours. The main rollouts don't really start until the second half of next year.
And you can look, and one of these programs, you can actually look and you can compare your energy use to the rest of the neighborhood.
That's right. We found, actually, that that's the biggest driver for change.
So really?
Seeing your consumption in isolation is one thing, but realizing that you consume a third more than your neighbors really does drive you to change. So so our biggest results, where we're able to publish information to you as a consumer that shows how well you do versus other people.
And so now at least you can monitor. But what about if you're at work during the day and you're suddenly realizing that things are skyrocketing?
Yeah, so we offer both the ability to do that remotely through the web while you're in the office, but also, and this is, I think, the more prevalent model, is to set a rule in your thermostat that says, keep an eye out for the price, and if the price changes, change the set point, and it'll do it automatically.
When you look at other conservation efforts, say wind power or solar power, and folks really just trying to get off the grid as much as possible, and you look at how much might be conserved by some of those types of alternatives, do you know how this might compare to those?
I know the types of savings we're able to achieve with our system, which is roughly about 15% of a household's consumption. And I think that the other technologies that are being invested in, the renewable energies and things, are all part of the puzzle. I don't see one solution blocking another, but I think that getting consumers visibility and control over their consumption is the start of educating them on the kinds of renewables they can use. So setting a rule for a washing machine on our system that says I only want to run the washing machine when there's enough wind power online in order to power it is a classic example of how you marry the types of information and control that we offer with the types of renewable energies that are coming online.
Do you think that it would have to be quite a shift for people to move from being passive consumers of power who simply just take it for granted and expect to flick a switch and not really think about it, to really making it part of someone's conscious decision-making as a homeowner and a power consumer?
I think it's worth stressing that in most cases, consumers will opt into programs and they won't perhaps think about things quite as much as you and I are playing with this system today. It'll be a sort of set-and-forget type program where you've set it up to be as ecological as possible or as economical as possible, and then the system will run itself.
So it's not really too much of a culture shift because you're going to make it as automatic as possible.
That's right.
Well, Adrian, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Adrian Tuck is CEO of Tendril. He's been talking with us about the advent of a smart grid in the U.S. power system. Before we go today, Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter Elvin Bishop sings the blues. You're listening to Here and Now. The The statistics for American women in the workforce are glum. On average, a woman earns only 73 cents to every dollar a man makes, and women hold less than 3% of the top jobs at U.S. companies. Could the reason why be as simple as women don't ask for what they want while men do? Well, that's the theory of two Carnegie Mellon researchers who published a book called Women Don't Ask: Negotiation and the Gender Divide. And that book changed the life of a San Diego woman who decided to test the theory by asking one question every day and then blogging about it. She calls herself Roxy. She doesn't want to reveal her real name, and her blog is called The Daily Asker. And Roxy, can you start by telling us some of the questions you've asked since you read the book?
Initially, I was sort of inspired by the book and its economic and social angle about women not asking and missing out on salaries and opportunities. And then over time, I think that it's gradually shifted towards something that continues to be about money, but also about experiences, knowledge. For example, maybe, can I see the inside of your house? Can I come along with you on a cooking expedition? That was something I asked a pair of professional chefs who have a restaurant in Seattle. The chef said, sure, come along. We go to Whole Foods every morning at 8 a.m., so yeah, why don't you come on Saturday? We're catering a wedding.
You also asked a police officer if you could borrow his Segway. He said no, but you did have better luck when you were on vacation in Maine. You asked for a free car rental upgrade?
Yeah, so I had rented, I believe it was a Chevy Impala. I don't quite remember. And I don't remember because I ended up getting a Mustang. So, and that was just, hi, can I get an upgrade? Sure.
And also, I read that you signed a lease.
I just signed a new lease on a really cute two-bedroom house, and that involved some requests for, you know, improvements. And normally I would have just signed it and, you know, gone away. And this time I thought, okay, what do I want, and how am I going to make sure that I get it? And so I requested, you know, changes of wallpaper, painting the bathroom blue, etc.
What about asking people questions that are more controversial? I'm thinking of the time you asked a woman who was smoking to move away from you.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, in my boyfriend's apartment, there's recently been a lot of smoke. And so I went to the balcony and saw that a woman was smoking there. And so, you know, in a very friendly demeanor, I approached her and said, hi, you know, is there any chance that you wouldn't mind using the other balcony if it makes no difference to you? She very kindly chose to go to the back balcony, and everybody was happy. But I might have just assumed, no, she wants to smoke there, I can't bother her. And instead I thought, big deal, so she'll just tell me no, which is something that I might not have done before.
And so it's the way you ask. When someone was sitting next to you on a bus and they were loud, you didn't say, could you shut up, please?
Of course. It's always friendly, maybe with a sense of humor and a sense of self-deprecation. Like, I'm sorry, I guess you've been putting up with my blabbering, so maybe we should both take a break now, ..
And is that exactly how you asked?
I was actually a little bit more to the point because he was not getting any of my subtle and not so subtle signals, including earplugs. So I finally just said, you know, I think I'm just going to enjoy the scenery for a moment. Do you mind if we stop talking?
And no angry response, no hard feelings?
No, not at all. He was a good sport.
What's maybe the most surprising thing that you asked for and did or didn't get?
You know, I would think that, especially given the economy right now, if I made a request in a retail setting, people would be willing to strike a deal. Like, I tried to ask for a rug discount. This is at Cost Plus, we have it in California, and they were just unwilling to negotiate. But on the flip side, I asked a pedicab driver in downtown San Diego if I could try test driving his bike taxi, and he just welcomed me on, and I definitely didn't think he would say yes there.
Now, what about professionally? Have you had to ask your boss for a raise?
I have asked my boss for a raise, and I got the raise.
Well, congratulations. Congratulations. So what do you think? What have you learned then about asking?
Well, the first thing I think is that you need to try to ask for more things than you want and then, you know, appear like you're settling, but you're actually getting more than you started out with. Another thing is to be persistent. Once you get turned down, just keep going. Try it in different ways. Another thing is, assume yes as an answer. I don't think if you shoot yourself down, then that's already going to be, you're giving yourself the answer. I mean, now, for example, I'll just approach a question and my attitude is, well, let's just see. You know, why wouldn't they say yes?
That's a woman who calls herself Roxy. She was inspired to keep a daily blog about trying to ask a question and negotiate every day after she read a book about how women don't often ask for what they want. Thanks, Roxy.
Thank you, Deb. It's been a pleasure.
If you have thoughts about this or any other story, our email address is letters@here-now.org. We'll be back in a minute. It's Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. 2008 has been a banner year for musician Elvin Bishop, who's probably best known as the writer of this 1976 pop hit, Fooled Around and Fell in Love, sung by Mickey Thomas. Elvin Bishop's longest love affair, though, has been with the blues, which he says started when he was a boy and heard the song Honest I Do on the radio. This year, his love has been requited. His latest CD, The Blues Rolls On, just got nominated for a Grammy Award.
The blues is just a blessing from a long time ago. A thing people can feel deep down in their soul. It was here before we were born.
We spoke with Elvin Bishop earlier this year, and we thought we'd take this opportunity to revisit that conversation. As we said, you've had a longtime love affair with the blues. What first drew you to the blues?
I don't know. See, I'm pretty old. I'm 65. I was born in 1942, and for the first 12 or 13 years of my life, I think the best that I could do was Frank Sinatra or How Much Is That Doggy in the Window? You know, that's what we had to work with in those days. Then rock came in, and then one day I was fooling around with the radio, and I heard blues for the first time, and it just knocked me to my knees. I thought, wow, that is so... I finally found out where the good part of rock was coming from.
Right.
After that, it was like a dog on a bone. I had to go check out the blues.
That's your version of the song that knocked you out, Honest I Do. So how did you learn to play after that? Did you listen to everything you could get your hands on?
Yeah, well, I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma is where I lived, and it was pretty strictly separated racially, you know. Not pretty strictly, very strictly. And I couldn't really go and find people playing blues. I could hear it on the radio, and then I started gradually finding out where I could find the records. I learned a couple of chords, and slowly, and I'd pick up the guitar, and it hurt my fingers, and I didn't have any better sense. I'd go to the pawn shop, and I'd buy one that had strings 2 inches off the fingerboard, and it would just kill me to play it, you know, and I'd quit. And then I'd take another look, and I'd listen to blues, and I'd say, I got to learn how to do that. And I'd watch the girls hanging around the guitar player, and I'd say, I really got to do that, you know. And I wasn't very good when I started out, but I went at it 24 hours a day, and I improved as fast as I could.
I come all the way from
Is there a part of you from Oklahoma that never really changed?
I grew up on a farm way out in the country, and we didn't have electricity or running water or any of that, you know. I always felt I had something in common with the old blues guys because I knew what it was like to live out in the country and 1,000 miles from nowhere. And, boy, you know, I'm a lot better at playing it than I am describing it.
Hmm. Let's go back to growing up in Oklahoma. You left Oklahoma, right, to attend the University of Chicago. And that's where you met Paul Butterfield, and you eventually formed the Paul Butterfield Blues Band.
I met Butterfield the first day I was in Chicago. There was a guy, a white guy, sitting on some steps playing a guitar and drinking a quart of beer, and he was playing blues. And I naturally just ran right over there and gravitated, and it was Butterfield. And for 3 or 4 years, our paths intermingled and crossed, and we played acoustically at parties and stuff.
And on your new CD, you revisit one of the songs from the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, Yonder's Wall. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Well, now your husband went to war. I heard it was kind of tough. Don't know how many men he killed, but I know it ain't good enough. But you look over yonder's wall. Hand me down my wall, KK. Well, I know you don't love me, cause baby, look who called your man.
Your new CD, The Blues Rolls On, is a tribute to some of the musicians who helped give you your start. And I'm sure that, you know, when you're young and you're passionate and that's sort of your driving force, you probably needed a lot of those musicians to help you out. Is that right? Is that what this CD is?
Yeah. It was a great blessing to me. Guys were much nicer to me than they had to be because I wasn't anybody. Like they used to say in Chicago, I was square as a pool table and twice as green. And the guys were really nice enough to bend over backwards and help me out a lot.
And, for example, on this CD, you invite the king of the blues, B.B. King, to be a part of this. And
yes! What a guy. Oh, he's the most gracious human being in the world. And just a great hero of mine.
Yeah, he's in the song, Keep a Dollar in Your Pocket. Let's listen a little bit.
Hey, here's something you ought to know. You ain't nowhere unless you got some dough. Keep a dollar in your pocket. Keep a dollar in your pocket.
Personally, he influenced me a whole lot. The example he set for me when I was a relatively young musician when I met him, and I was maybe, having a little too much fun in spots, and then I messed up and got a hit, and I thought I was thinking maybe just a little too much of myself, you know. And B.B., when I first met him, he invited me up to his hotel in San Francisco, and I went up there, and here he was. He was, as far as I was concerned, the absolute pinnacle of the blues world, the number one guy. He lets me in his room, and he's got sheet music spread all over his bed. He's in his dressing gown, and he's just slaving away on these scales and exercises and stuff. I thought, wow, this guy's got it made, but he's just in the habit of progressing and bettering himself, and this was a great example for me.
Boy, that looks like B.B. King coming.
Heard people say the blues is something that a musician lives, right? Something that an artist has to deeply feel. Now, how does a kid who's as square as a pool table and twice as green sort of get that depth of feeling that many people think is needed to be a successful blues artist?
It just seems like some people gravitate to blues. Blues is never going to be for everybody, like rap or country, you know, the hugely dominant musical form. For most people, I think music is kind of a surface thing, a trendy thing. You know, it's like hairstyles or clothing. But blues people, they want to connect the music up with life, you know. They want something deeper from their music.
Musician Elvin Bishop. His CD, The Blues Rolls On, has just been nominated for a Grammy for Best Traditional Blues Album. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend. And please join us again, Here and Now.
Rock is tough enough.